Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger, Director of Editorial in the USA for CityWire, and I'm joined, as ever, by CityWire RIA editor Ian Wenig in the studio.
I wish that people could see you gesturing your hand towards me as if I'm some massive star about to take the stage.
Ian Wenig, exactly. And we're also joined, I can gesture to a laptop now for this, by Andrew Forsch, who is joining us from Washington, D.C. Andrew is, of course, Deputy Editor of CityWire RIA. Andrew, great to have you back on the pod.
As always, yeah, hello.
Brilliant. Well, look, we've got a lot to get through today. I think we've got two big stories. The first of which is, it's not quite a resolution, but it's the end of a long-running story and long-running lawsuit, a lawsuit that's been going for about 2 years, a story that we've been covering, I suppose, on and off ever since. Andrew, it's what you're here to talk about, but it is a suit that's been going on between Mercer, the large mega RIA, roll-up aggregator, however you want to describe them or they want to describe themselves, and a firm called ACG Wealth, which we struggle with how to describe it. We call it a target firm, an acquiree. It was a firm that they acquired, basically. But then that deal went south once it was closed. So I don't know, where do you want to start, with the latest thing or with the deep, deep background?
Yeah, well, I think, the headline is that there's been a settlement. You're right, this is one of the kind of messier acquisition implosions in recent memory, at least among those implosions that are happening sort of in the public domain. I mean, I think deals probably go wrong more than we, the press and the general public, know about, but this one was all out in the open. And it's over now. So the parties have all reached a settlement. There was kind of a long series of claims brought by Mercer and then counterclaims brought by the ACG advisors. All of that has now been resolved. And this also sort of coincides with the timing of the former ACG co-founders' launch of a new RIA. So we can get into all of that. And if it's helpful, maybe I'll kind of get into some of the context and the background of the case.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I think we probably have to, don't we? I think it's, all good sort of written journalists would say, don't start with context, start with the news. But actually, one, audio format is different. And two, yeah, for those listeners not familiar with all this, I think we probably have to get them up to speed. So yeah, maybe, as fast as you can and as sort of smoothly as possible, let's go.
Sure. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of kind of fun and interesting detail here. So to start, we'll go back to 2021. Mercer, which, yeah, most listeners will know as a private equity backed strategic serial acquirer. They buy an Atlanta area RIA called ACG Wealth, had about $1.3 billion in client assets at the time. Seems like a fairly standard deal. We write about it. Frankly, we probably forget about it for a while. And then things move forward. 2023, Mercer sues the company and its three co-founders, whose names are Jeffrey Shaver, Jody Young, and David Milliken. But the lawsuit is filed under seal, so the public did not have access to the actual initial complaint, nor any of the exhibits filed to support that complaint. Now, I think it was just before the lawsuit was filed, if I'm remembering correctly, maybe I'm not, but I know that Ian and I both heard from a source that the ACG advisors allegedly violated their purchase agreement by selling Mercer revenue that wasn't theirs. So that is what we understood the lawsuit to hinge on, was some of the revenue that was sold to Mercer actually belonged to advisors working under Form 1099 independent contractor agreements with ACG. And we, asked Mercer about that. They didn't indicate that that was inaccurate. And as part of that initial action, Mercer also sued, this is sort of a tangent, but Mercer also sued another advisor, a former ACG advisor who had joined through the acquisition and then turned around and left to a different RIA. That advisor took some clients with them. Mercer sued for the typical, sort of.
So there's, maybe we'll come back to that, because there's a series of kind of parallel almost sort of suits that Mercer has also launched around advisors who came and or went from ACG. But let's focus just on the ACG part of it for now. So they so effectively it's classic stuff, isn't it? You know, basically they, as we understand it, or at least or understood it at the time, the sort of inference was there's maybe, yeah, there were, they thought they bought more assets than they had, because obviously 1099 different from W-2, less sticky, et cetera.
And in order to buy that revenue, I mean, they would have had to pay off the 1099 advisors or convince them to come in-house, and that's just cost and time that I guess they felt that they didn't agree to or didn't know was associated with the deal. So that's
but
the
that's
crux
not
of it.
How, that's not how the ACG people saw it. They countersued.
They did, yeah. A few months later, they filed a counter-complaint. This is Shaver and Young. They filed a counter-complaint against Mercer, alleging that Mercer actually was the one that sabotaged the deal, basically by preventing one of their top advisors from transitioning her full book of business over after the deal, and thus stopping ACG from meeting a revenue threshold that would have entitled them to, I think it was $6.9 million in additional sort of back-end earnouts. And they also brought a defamation claim. They said that Mercer's claim that it fired them for cause in March of 2023 was basically so that they didn't have to pay them severance benefits. If you fire somebody, you got to pay them severance, but if you fire them for cause, then they relinquish you know, the right to collect those severance benefits. So this is all, so this goes on for months. There are you know, dozens of filings. Mercer had subpoenaed an independent broker-dealer called Arcadios, which was run by one of ACG's co-founders, who left to run that business in 2017. He never joined Mercer. He wasn't an employee of ACG at the time of the sale. Mercer also subpoenaed an Atlanta area country club. This is kind of a fun detail. Basically, they were trying to get documents from the country club on when and how often the advisors were visiting and playing golf, as well as their expenses at bars and restaurants. They're accusing the advisors here of going and hanging out at the club and playing golf after the sale instead of, you know, doing their jobs as advisors and continuing to bring on new business. So that's kind of fun. And I don't think the country club ever responded. I should know this, but I don't believe those documents ever popped up in the court docket, which of course would have been fun to sift through.
Indeed so. Yeah, just going through advisors' bar bills and stuff. It's a new form of journalism, but one I think we're all here for, to be honest with you. I think if one takes a step back and maybe oversimplifies it, so effectively, you know, both sides are sort of saying, well, Mercer's saying there weren't as many assets as you said there might be, and that once you're in, you guys weren't doing as much as you possibly could to ensure as many of those came over. And the ACG people are saying, well, actually, hang on a second, you were making it harder for us to do that so that you didn't have to pay us out as much as you could have done. And further to that, in you know, then got rid of us as well in such a way that you didn't have to pay us out. So sort of you were the ones trying not to pay as much as you could possibly pay, and Mercer in reverse saying you guys weren't, you know, trying to bring the assets over. So it really comes down to those points. Okay, and then what happened after that? So claim, counterclaim.
Yeah. There were a few, you know, a couple of, this is over the course of a few years, some other advisors left. Mercer is pursuing claims against those advisors. You know, discovery is being held. A lot of that is something of a black box for folks who are not inside of the courtroom. So unfortunately, that is what is sort of dissatisfying for the general public, the observer, about what, you know, kind of the ultimate resolution of this. It's a settlement, right? So both parties have reached terms that they agree to. We don't know the terms of that settlement. We don't know who had to pay who. We don't know kind of where the court ultimately came down on, basically who is right and who is wrong in this conflict, to kind of oversimplify it.
And we don't know, I suppose, as well, we don't know how many assets eventually did come over. So, you know, we mentioned it was a $1.3 billion firm at the time the deal was done. Obviously, that number is not static, but let's just pretend for the sake of this conversation, we don't know what number ended up coming over. We can suspect it was less, because this court case wouldn't have happened one way or the other if it had been the exact amount. And then we also know, what we do know, I suppose, then, is that Shaver and Young are starting again their own RAA. and they're obviously able to do so. And we think that the timing of the settlement is somewhat tied into that point.
It feels that way. I mean, I'm not sure what kind of garden leave they might have had after, really being terminated by Mercer. But it was, you know, they got fired in March of 2023, and they set up the new RIA in the summer of this year. That company is called TRG Wealth Management. They're running that with two former Homrich Berg advisors. Homrich Berg is now known as HB Wealth. That's also a big RIA based in Atlanta. So Shaver's the CEO there. Young is the president. And yeah, when you're starting up a new company, trying to grow, trying to run a new business, you don't want this sort of legal battle hanging over your head. So I can't say for certain that the two are related, but they're, you know, the timing certainly lines up.
Interesting. And then last thing on this before, well, one, bring it in to talk perhaps more a little bit about Mercer's, acquisition streak, what it was doing in terms of M&A at the time of this deal. Before we get to that, just very quickly, then, we mentioned this before, there are these sort of further cases that are ongoing. So this one's tied up, but Mercer does have two or three lawsuits with advisors who had left ACG, weren't founders, but obviously then had gone on to join other firms, and I suppose take clients with them, thus take assets with them, further impacting this book of business that Mercer had acquired. And while this sort of bigger ongoing case is settled, those suits are not settled. They, as far as we know, those continue to run. Mercer still pursuing those advisors for whatever it was they were pursuing them for, like breach of contract, client solicitation, those kinds
of
things.
More of the standard, you sue a breakaway advisor kind of thing that we see all the time and report on all the time. But yeah, there was at least two advisors left to form a new RIA earlier this year. I think at the time that Mercer filed suit, they maybe had taken $90 or $100 million of assets. So that's a fraction of, you can assume that they're pulling from the ACG, the former ACG book. Maybe that's not a safe assumption, but we're going to speculate a little bit there. So that's a little bit. And there's an advisor left to another RIA. I think his name is Kevin Rainwater back, when the first ACG suit was still filed. So yeah, there has been some attrition, and you can assume that those advisors who have exited have taken some of their client relationships with them.
Impressive stuff, Andrew. So channeling your inner Ian Wenig there to, recount 2 years worth of legal claims and RIA history. So thank you for that.
It only took 13 minutes, but here we are.
Yeah, hey, that was pretty good, I thought. Who's timing? Ian, very quickly then, because I know we've got other stuff to talk about as well, but Mercer, obviously, as discussed, big aggregator roll up, whatever you want to call it, large enterprise RIA. When it did this deal back in whatever it was, over 2 years ago, what kind of strategy was it pursuing sort of M&A wise, and has that changed since?
I mean, I kind of view this deal similar to, like, I view it as a vestige of the era when people were willing to pay millions for pictures of cartoon monkeys, because Mercer around,
a bit harsh here comparing it to an NFT, but sure, let's run with the analogy for the time being.
Around that time, Mercer was pursuing this strategy where they're paying these really aggressive earnout structures where transactions would be paid out. So basically, for context for our listeners,
this is 2021, and by aggressive, we mean effectively generous. So yes. Aggressive as in aggressive versus its rivals to do the deal.
Exactly. Yeah. So just for context, generally, if you're an RIA seller, you have some sort of cash component, some sort of equity component, and that cash component usually has an earnout, which vests over a period of maybe 4 years, 5 years, and the idea is that you keep the sellers who brought on the clients, you keep them affiliated with the firm and incentivize them to keep driving business. Mercer, and I talked about this with Dave Barton, who is, unfortunately, he's no longer with Mercer. He stepped away about a year ago. He was Mercer's CEO and then their top deal maker. You know, Dave explained to me a couple years ago around that time that they were paying these structures where the earnout could be as short as a year. I don't 100% remember. I think it might have been as short as 6 months or less than a year at times. And when you have that, there's nothing tying the selling advisor to the firm. And so when, again, I'm not going to, this is not
commenting. We don't know for sure that was the structure of this deal, we should say. But we know they were talking about it at that time, and we know the deal was done at this
time. And without specifically commenting on the truth or falsity of these allegations that these ACG Wealth guys were playing golf during working hours and hanging out at the country club.
You could do a lot of business there as well, to be fair.
That is true. But a hypothetical scenario in which a selling advisor accepts a deal with like a almost zero earnout clause, has nothing sticking to them, then just acting like a fired college football coach golfing during the day, that doesn't shock me if that's an outcome that's happened before in some sort of RA transaction. Again, separating that from the specifics of this case.
Yeah, okay. And what's Mercer up to these days? Are they still doing a lot of deals? And if they are, do we have any insight, and we may not, as to whether the structure of those deals remains similar?
They're still active. We don't have specific color in terms of how they're kind of handling earnouts now. But it's worth noting that, you know, Mercer's raised money a couple times. They have a bunch of different capital providers now. They have a Singaporean sovereign wealth fund, GSC, as an investor in them too. They have three different private equity sponsors. They did a preferred equity raise during the market swoon in 2022. So they have a lot of stakeholders, and they've stayed active even through this kind of incident.
Excellent. All right. Well, look, thank you both. I think we've covered that in a lot of detail, and it may not be the last time we talk about that particular lawsuit, but it more than likely is, probably. But I suppose let's see what happens with those sort of remaining advisor cases. So let's pivot now to another deal, but not one that has imploded, or hasn't imploded yet, at least, because it's only been announced today as we record. So, Ian, this is the story of LPL Financial. Could we almost call them friend of the pod? I'm sure if we did some sort of analysis at the end of the year of companies that we've named the most on the podcast, LPL's almost definitely in the top three, possibly rivaling old Charles Schwab for number one most mentions.
Creative planning up there too, probably.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they're all gagging to find out. But regardless, done a big deal. So it's bought a firm called Private Advisor Group, which was in fact an OSJ within LPL, but this is the first time, as I understand it, and you can tell me otherwise, that LPL is actually a direct investor in that business. So maybe, again, this one's a bit easier. Let's start at the top with the new news, and then we'll work backwards and get into the context.
You know, I was thinking about kind of your first point, which is that, you know, how sometimes with sitcoms you have a guest star or a minor character who eventually comes to the focus of the whole show, like Steve Urkel in Family Matters.
Sure, I've never seen it, but yes, I know the...
Yeah, okay, I mean, LPL is kind of at that point, it feels like sometimes.
Okay, a sort of interloper in our pod experience.
Yes.
Okay.
So basically, for context, the new news here is that LPL has taken a minority stake in Private Advisor Group, which is one of its largest OSJs. I believe it has north of $40 billion in assets. And this is significant for a couple of reasons. I think one is, we talked about this a little bit on the pod before, was that LPL and its relationship with its OSJs has been somewhat fraught in recent years, where last year we broke a series of stories about how LPL tried to change the terms of its contractual agreements with these OSJs. And for context, additional context, OSJs...
I was going to say, next question is, for those not familiar, what are OSJs?
Yeah. So an OSJ, this business is filled with so many acronyms. An OSJ is an Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction. And what an OSJ does is it is not owned by the underlying broker-dealer, but it conducts brokerage business through an independent broker-dealer, maybe custody some client assets there, and is owned by an independent entity, and a lot of times has its own RIA arm set up. So a good example of this would be Stratos. That's a large LPL OSJ. For years, Ron Carson operated as an OSJ affiliated with LPL.
So basically a large wealth management practice that affiliates with a larger broker-dealer and will use that broker-dealer for its brokerage business, among other things. But it also gets, because of the size of them in terms of assets, advisors, and sort of complexity, they also get somewhat...
Yes.
They're obviously favored by the broker-dealers because they're a large chunk of their asset base.
Exactly. They get preferential pricing for service. And in some cases, the broker-dealer will actually help fund the OSJ's advisor recruiting. And so,
because it obviously benefits them if that entity is growing.
Yes. And so, for context, many of these, I feel like we use that a lot today. a lot of these OSJs have acquired some sort of institutional, again, another Steve Urkel guest star, private equity backing. Some examples would be Wealth Enhancement, which is no longer part of LPL, but they've been backed by TA Associates and Onex Corporation. Stratos, which I mentioned, they are backed by Emigrant Partners, which is a different type of sponsor, but we can get into that later, now selling a majority stake to SEI.
Okay, so let's get back quickly to what you were saying before we went down the what is an OSJ tangent. You were saying that there has been something in recent times, year or so, of a little bit of a friction between LPL and some of the OSJs, because I think to what you're saying here, the OSJs are growing. They have historically been core to LPL's growth, but is this fair? There was a worry that obviously LPL's done a lot to help them, well, a worry from LPL, that LPL done a lot to help them grow, but now someone else, a third party, could come in, buy a stake in that business. That business was big enough and strong enough to go and stand by itself and leave LPL. And then LPL perhaps felt that it wasn't seeing the benefit, the return on its own investment in those practices. So it tried in the last year to sort of set out some ground rules that would give it a bit more control and more of a stake in those funds' growth.
Put brutally simply, LPL was tired, and from a business perspective, probably you could argue justifiably so, of these OSJs growing into multi-billion dollar enterprises, making money for sponsors off recruiting funds on an LPL's dime.
Got it. Okay. So let's talk about that. It sent a letter out to them
last year.
Which so effectively said,
LPL was basically trying to change these contractual terms to say, if you are going to go for, again, we're giving you the benefit of just memory, this is a couple months old, but basically LPL was trying to say, if you're going to try to get outside sponsorship, we want right of first refusal. We want to have a seat at the table, have the opportunity to bid. And some firms accepted those terms and others didn't. We had a couple of firms, Merit Financial Advisors was the biggest one, which has now backed by Constellation Wealth Capital. They ultimately chose to disaffiliate from LPL. They moved their brokerage business elsewhere. Wealth Enhancement, I mentioned them earlier, wasn't necessarily directly connected to the LPL letter, but they moved their brokerage business and disaffiliated from LPL. So LPL did lose some people.
And those firms do lose something for doing that, right? Because they did get some recruitment help. Yes. They did get preferential pricing. So it wasn't as if they gave up nothing to just go and leave, but they just felt that it wasn't worth, those terms weren't to their liking, I suppose.
Yeah, there's no bad guy in that kind of scenario. I think LPL had a legitimate business reason for trying to make the changes that it did. And I think the firms that weren't willing to accept that were totally within their rights to say, we don't want to be a part of that anymore.
Okay, and then bringing this back to
the news of the day.
Yeah, private advisor group. Why is that relevant to this particular deal?
So it's worth noting that LPL is, as far as I can recall, this is the first time that they've taken a direct stake in a firm since the letter brouhaha. And it's worth noting that private advisor group's existing minority sponsor, Merch Investment Management, is remaining an investor in the company. So LPL is coming in alongside as opposed to taking out Merchant.
Okay, so possibly we're drawing a dotted line here, which we don't know for sure, between that letter and then them doing this. So
yes, that's fair.
PAG in this, we could theoretically have been looking for an outside investor. LPL said, well, per the terms of this, we would want to have a voice in that conversation, and then has decided to buy a stake. So perhaps that brings us on to the actual deal. We don't know the size of the stake what's been paid or anything there. What do we know?
Yeah, I mean, basically what we know is that they are coming in as a kind of co-investor alongside Merchant. They've described this kind of like...
We don't know if Merchant's changing. We don't know what Merchant's stake was before.
I don't know how much the Merchant may be selling. They might not be selling at all, or how much they're rolling over. But basically, I believe that PAG is controlled by its employees. So now you have this LPL with a seat at the table alongside Merchant.
Interesting. And obviously, at the start of this, we sort of mentioned how much we've talked about LPL this year on this podcast. And that's really a product of its bigger acquisition this year, probably the biggest acquisition in the space this year, its deal for Commonwealth. So does this fit at all in with that, with Commonwealth? I think one thing we've talked about is, you know, a lot of its assets are advisory. It's sort of LPL, I guess, obviously, the more of its assets are advisory, the better for it, as we know, they're valued higher, et cetera. Does that fit with this? You know, a lot of, you mentioned most OSJs will have a large advisory business. I don't know if we know off the top of our head what the breakdown of PAG's business is between advisory and brokerage, but does this sort of, is this too much of a leap for me to be saying this is more of the same from LPL, as in acquiring more advisory assets effectively and getting more of its own business mix to be advisory versus brokerage?
I kind of view this as more of a defensive move,
okay,
to be honest, because these are assets that are already on the platform. This feels like more of a retention play as opposed to going out and scooping up and bringing new assets.
Okay.
Like, they're not adding anything to this, but it's interesting because it sets a fascinating precedent for what they might do with other OSJs.
Excellent. Yeah, interesting. Okay. Anything else to say about this?
They do. LPL does have stakes in some other OSJs. I think they're a minority backer of Independent Advisor Alliance, which I don't know off the top of my head how large that is. It's tens of billions of dollars in assets. And there's one or two others, a smaller one. I think Great Valley, maybe Sam reported on. So they have invested in OSJs in the past, and maybe this is a harbinger of more to come. I don't know.
I find this interesting because they're coming in alongside a sponsor.
Okay. So I think, I can't remember, did I say out loud at this point? Did I say earlier that this was the first time they'd done this? So if I did, scratch that from the record. If I didn't.
Well, we believe it's the first.
Scratch
since
this
the
part
letter.
From the record.
Since the letter.
Yeah. That counts.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was really getting at. Sure. Okay, fantastic. Well, look, a really good, an interesting story there. And obviously the merchant story equally very interesting. Very quickly, before we wrap up then, all this M&A, something that we write about a lot, something that we put a lot of focus on. Next year, it won't just be journalists who'll be looking at this. Sam, our resident regulatory correspondent, isn't able to join us today, but he did do a great piece this week, which looked at all the SEC's exam priorities for 2026. And there's lots of the things on there that you'd expect, lots of the usual stuff. But one thing that he noted, which was new and obviously stuck out to us, was that the regulator will be looking at RIA, M&A. So I don't want to spend too long on this because we've probably gone over time here. But what's the gist of this, Ian? And do all your contacts and lots of our readers have anything to worry about?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Short answer to me is I'm not a lawyer or a compliance or a CCO, so I can't specifically comment on that. But just for for a little bit of background, you know, the SEC's functionality was limited during the government shutdown. They weren't able to get new RIAs online. A lot of deals, a lot of stuff happened while the SEC was basically in shutdown mode. And what came out this week was the SEC releasing its priorities for 2026 exams. As you know, RIAs are regularly audited and examined by the SEC. And they basically said that RIA M&A is going to be one of those exam priorities. So if you are kind of, I don't know what it's like to be audited by the SEC, but
I can't imagine it's tons of fun.
No, but it's just something to be, it's just an area of focus. Also, they're going to be focusing on private credit investments as well.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I mean, obviously two of the largest trends going on in the wealth management space. Well, okay. Thank you. I think we've covered that. We've covered two brilliant stories. I suppose lastly, Ian, we spoke a lot about TV recommendations on the last podcast to wrap us up. Anything further you've been watching that you want to share with the listeners?
Sadly, no. I haven't added any new shows in the last week or
you've
so.
You've been all sports the last few days, haven't you? You've been all about college basketball.
Yes, I was at the Penn victory over St. Joe's on Monday. It was very funny.
Everyone's talking about that, yeah.
Very fun. No, well, a PR person texted because they saw me on TV during that game.
TV or a live stream on the internet?
What's the difference at this point?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, true. And then you went to the Duke game yesterday.
Yes, I did go to the Champions Classic yesterday, and Duke looked pretty solid. They got a better game from Kansas than I expected.
Excellent. Would you say that college basketball or Major League Baseball, if you had to choose one, where would you?
They're tied. I can't choose between one. They're both tied for second.
Okay. Well, and first?
Fourth, NFL's number one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The things I learned. Andrew, before we go, either TV recommendations or sports updates. What have you got?
No, I've been on when I do the night shift with the baby. I'm trying to watch something that is. I know she doesn't. You know, the TV is just moving colors to her. But I feel bad watching just like Hollywood BS. So I've been on a big Tony Bourdain kick lately. So I'm going back watching like No Reservations and parts unknown and stuff. I feel like it's somehow more valuable for her to be exposed even at a couple months old.
Yeah.
Just like
no.
Different countries, different people, different cultures than some just like kind of fiction dreck. I don't know, you know.
I like that. I like the idea that from a very young age, she's going to be not ordering fish on a Monday because she's being exposed to Bourdain.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, look, on that wholesome and hearty note, I think we're called time on this episode of the podcast. So thank you very much indeed, Andrew and Ian. And of course, thank you, listener, for tuning in. And we'll be back again very soon with another episode of This Week in Wealth.